Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
And he said, God damn it to hell, the kid is dead. Why don't people stop asking me or leave me alone? And he slammed the phone down. I can't tell you what it feels like to have Paul Newman hang up on you. I still get chills thinking about it.
Welcome all to episode 39 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Diane K. Shaw. Diane has had a rich and varied career. She blazed a trail as a top national sports writer and columnist, and in 1981 she became the first female sports columnist for US Daily Newspaper at the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. She's also written mystery novels along with magazine features on a range of topics and personalities, and has been featured by the likes of the New York Times, Esquire, GQ, Playboy, and Newsweek. She celebrated her 75th birthday in April during lockdown in New York and has recently released her memoir, which goes by the fabulous title, A Farewell to Arms, Legs and Jockstraps, a sportswriter's memoir. A quick reminder, as always, you can get in touch with the show. Email behindthelines@the42.ie or you can tweet me. I'm at gcooney93. You can also join our members' WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. Let's get on with said podcast and let's get talking to Diane K. Shaw. Diane, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure.
So, how did you become a sports writer?
I'm not quite sure. I wanted to be a journalist, and as a kid, I loved baseball, and it really didn't occur to me that I wanted to put the two together. But back then, women weren't really people didn't like to hire women for any journalism jobs. And I remember when I was a senior in high school, my guidance counselor called me in and said, well, what do you want to do after college? And I said, I would like to write for Time or Newsweek magazine. And he said, no, Time and Newsweek, they're written by 15 middle-aged men. They would never hire you. What else would you like to do? And I hadn't really thought about this, so I just said, well, I want to be a sports writer. And he said, oh, Diane, you can't go into locker rooms. No editor's going to hire you. I think you better go home and think more realistically about your future. I did then get a journalism job, but I have to say that it wasn't easy. I graduated with a journalism degree from Indiana University and got married, moved to Washington, D.C., and I contacted every newspaper, radio station, TV station, wire service, magazine. And back then, managing editors would say things like, well, you just got married. You're going to be having babies. We can't hire you. Or one man said, well, we have an opening on the 4 to midnight shift, but we wouldn't let a girl do that. So the thought of becoming a sports writer, I couldn't even get a journalism job. Finally, I did. It was very lucky. It was for a weekly newspaper called the National Observer. It was published by Dow Jones, which publishes the Wall Street Journal, and it was really held in high regard. And they liked my stories. They liked my work, and they started letting me do whatever I wanted. Well, having been a big baseball fan, I would from time to time do a baseball story or even a football story. But I didn't want to do it full time because I was having so much fun covering political conventions, interviewing famous people. I went to the White House several times. Why would I want to just sit in a press box? But then my paper folded and I was hired by Newsweek magazine, believe it or not. And lo and behold, they made me a sports writer. So despite what my guidance counselor said, I got a job at Newsweek and I became a sports writer. And I was doing that for a year or two, maybe. And then I got hired to go to Los Angeles to be a sports columnist. And they told me that I was the first female sports columnist for a daily newspaper in the United States. And so then it became very full time, and I just loved it.
Did you ring your guidance counselor when you got the job at Newsweek as a sports writer?
I should have. I should have. But, you know, that's the way things kind of were back then. I remember after I graduated college and couldn't find a job, nobody'd hire me. All the guys who had been in my journalism class, they all got hired. So I understood what was going on. I knew what was going on. But anyway, that's how I became a sports columnist, I should say.
So all journalists, Diane, I think, dream of having some one-liner piece of criticism that we can all put on a business card. So can you please tell us how you were once accused of, quote, destroying the American family?
Yes. One of my early ventures into sports writing, I wanted to do a piece about the Boston Red Sox, who I think they were competing for the pennant that year. It was September. I thought they'd be a good story. And I went through quite a procedure. I had to get past two men. One controlled the field and the dugouts and the locker room. The other controlled the press box. And neither of them wanted me to be there. Dow Jones, I was still with the National Observer, their lawyer made a phone call, and hours before the first game I was wanted to cover. And they said, oh, well, all right, as long as she behaves herself. Literally, they said that. And they called a meeting in the locker room with the Red Sox. Hey, guys, there's this girl on the field. Watch your language. So I got there, and I went down on the field, and none of the players would talk to me. They just kind of, they didn't leave or walk away. They just kind of stood there. I found out later that they were afraid they'd say a bad word and insult me in some way or horrify me. But anyway, the big problem was their PR man, a man named Bill Crowley, and he fought hard to keep me away. And then eventually back down. So finally they bring me, before the game, Bill Crowley's assistant gave me a tour of Fenway Park. So we ended up on the roof, which is where they had the press room. And he opened the door to the press room and he said, you can't go in there. And then he pointed to the left and there was a door that said women. And he said, except you can go there to use the bathroom. This is where the reporters would have dinner before the game. I couldn't go in there, but they had set up a table for me right outside the door with a single place setting and a sign that said, ladies pavilion. I said, thank you, I'm really not hungry. So they finally bring me into the press box. And the assistant is sitting with Bill Crowley on one side and me on the other. Crowley does not speak to me. Finally, around the fourth inning or so, I introduced myself. And he said, see what you've done. See what you've done. Tomorrow there'll be 50 girls here. And I said, well, Mr. Crowley, I don't think there are 50 female sports writers. He said, well, they say they are, just so they can go after my boys. And then he said, you are going to destroy the American family. And I failed. I did, I think.
What did you say back when he said you destroy the American family?
I just shook my head, smiled, and returned my attention to the game. But interesting, I was there for six games. And the Red Sox did very well. And they all began to like me. They thought I was bringing them good luck. And so I guess I won my battle there anyway. But that kind of treatment, I originally, and I didn't mention this before, rather than let me sit in the press box, they were going to get me a seat in the stadium and have the players I wanted to interview come to my seat. And I don't know if you remember much about Carl Yastrzemski. He was the star of the team, and he wasn't a nice guy to anybody. And I was just trying to picture him climbing up the stands to have an interview with me. that, of course, never happened. So,
yeah.
Interesting time.
So I would guess by the way the Red Sox dealt with you, you were the first woman that they had ever met.
Actually, one of the, oh, the press box guy, he didn't want me in the press box. Why not? Well, we had a girl in the press box and it was a disaster. I said, well, what happened? Well, she was in the press box and a foul ball hit her on the shoulder. I said, oh, okay. What? They had to get used to us. But I have to say, it was considered such a big deal that I was on the TV news and in the Boston Globe, everybody writing about this thing happening. Boston was difficult in many ways. It's been known as a racist city, and I think some of the black ball players in the sports, basketball, baseball, have felt it. And I think they were the last team to hire a black baseball player. Yeah. So Boston could be difficult.
Yeah. Did you get into the locker room, by the way?
Well, back then, this original story, that was before any woman had been in a locker room. The locker rooms came a few years later. I never even attempted to get in. I just wanted field credentials and the press box. But then towards the end of the 70s, a couple of New York female sports journalists, I think they sued the Rangers hockey team because they couldn't get in. Anyway, they won, and one by one, they began to let us in.
Mm. And Diane, are you consciously seeing yourself as a trailblazer back at this time?
No, only in the respect that I didn't screw up for other women. I was one of the first. I was the first columnist. I was one of the first reporters in a locker room, yes. But there were women coming at that time. Not a lot, a few. And my biggest fear was that I, especially when I became a columnist, because back then, not so much today, but back then, if you were a sports columnist, everybody in town knew you. Everybody read you. Everybody knew who you were. I didn't want to screw up and then have other women not be able to get jobs. So I think of myself more in those terms.
Yeah, but even that is quite a burden to carry around for you, as an almost spokesperson for women in sports writing.
I guess you could. Well, there was I didn't want to be interviewed. I really just wanted to be another sports writer doing her job. Once in a while, I would give an interview, and at the time, I don't know, maybe it still exists, there was a publication called Playgirl magazine, and this woman who worked for Playgirl called me up and interviewed me on the phone. And when the story came out, I had to laugh because she said, oh, on Diane's narrow shoulders rests the hopes of all these women, blah, blah, blah. And it just made me laugh. I don't know. I didn't think of myself like that.
Yeah. You ended up as the first female sports writer with a national column in Los Angeles. Can you talk to us about how that came about?
Well, in a very unlikely way, yes. I was a writer at Newsweek magazine, which was based in New York at the time. Excuse me. And I was out in Los Angeles doing two or three stories on a week between Christmas and New Year's. And one of my friends told me that he was taking a job with the Los Angeles Herald Examiner because the editor of the paper, Jim Bellows, was one of the most distinguished newspaper editors in the country. And I said, oh, someday I'd love to meet him. Well, that week, my friend David said, oh, I just found out Jim's having a party tonight. Why don't you come with me? You can meet him. I said, oh, okay. So I did. I went, and Jim Bellows greeted me at the door of his home, And he led me into the living room. There were a whole bunch of people there. And he sat me down on a sofa, brought me something to drink. And then he looks at me. The first words he says to me are, "So, Diane, what are you going to do for the rest of your life?" I said, "What?" And he said, "You know, what do you want to do? What kind of work do you want to do?" I said, "Oh, okay, well, one of these days I'm going to leave Newsweek and I'm going to write magazine stories and mystery novels." "No," he said, "I don't think so." And I said, "No, really, that's what I want to do." And he's, "No." And I said, "Well, Mr. Bellows, you know, I've already written for several magazines and I had one mystery novel published already. So yes, that's what I want to do." And he said, "No, I don't think so." Well, now I'm getting defensive. And I said, "Okay, so what do you think I should do?" And he said, "You're going to be my sports columnist at the LA Herald Examiner." I said, "What?" And I argued, and I said, "Look, I don't know how to write a column. I don't even read them. I've never worked for a daily paper, and I don't know anything about Los Angeles." And he said, "Don't worry, I can teach you anything you need to know about writing." And I have to say, he was known as somebody that recruited great, talented writers or helped people become great writers. So it took me a few months to make this decision, but what really made me take the job was the fact that I could sort of sit at his knee and learn how to write a great column. So that's how I took the job.
I was going to ask.
It didn't work out that way, but that's why I took the job.
I was going to ask, Diane, if there were any columnists who influenced you, but it sounds like you didn't really read many before you took the job.
No, let me take that back. I did read, being in New York, I read Red Smith in the New York Times, who had to be one of the best ever. The man I worked with at Newsweek, Pete Axthelm, was a brilliant man and one of the best. In fact, I wish I had this particular story that he wrote, but it was in the summer. George Steinbrenner, who owned the Yankees, fired the manager, Billy Martin, for the fifth time. He kept firing the guy and then rehiring him. This was the fifth time. And Pete's lead paragraph, in it, he quoted the French philosopher Albert Camus. And I'm looking at this. It was brilliant. And I said, "How could you put Camus in the same paragraph with Billy Martin?" But it was a time when we could be creative and we could have fun. And I'm not sure that that's possible now because the way we cover sports is so different.
Why is it not possible now? Like, what has changed in your opinion?
I think two things have changed. One, looking back, I feel lucky that I was doing my sports writing late 70s, 80s, early 90s, when athletes would actually spend time with you. You could walk into the LA Dodgers locker room a couple hours before a game. All the players are in there getting dressed. You could sit, talk with them for a while and pick up little stuff, you know, pick up information. After the game, you go in the locker room. They were still there. You could talk to them. Today, you walk into a basketball locker room, a football locker room, a baseball locker room, and there's nobody there except other reporters. And athletes use a lot of social media. They don't, in many ways, they don't even need sports writers. They can say what they want to say. And I think that a lot of the things I read are a lot shorter. Our attention spans have shrunk. And I don't read everything I should, but by and large, I think it's just different.
So obviously you faced absurd hardship, particularly in the early days of your sports writing career, for merely being a woman. But was there an element of that was a better time to be a writer than now, in spite of what you faced early on in your career?
Well, I think that's two separate issues. It was a better time to be a writer because you had the space and you had the time and you had the athletes. I'd like to give you one example. I write about this in the book. There was a pitcher named Jim Palmer, and he was one of the best in all of baseball. He pitched for the Baltimore Orioles. This was the mid to late 70s, I think. And he would often win 20 games a season. And back then, many times the starting pitcher would complete the game. Forget the relief pitchers hadn't been invented yet the way they are now. So Jim would have a lot of complete games. He was definitely one of the best, and I thought I should do a story about him. And so I was given his address in Maryland, where he lived, and told to show up, I don't know, 10:30. So I go, and he answers the door. He's holding a scythe in one hand, and he leads me through the house out to the backyard, and he's explaining that his wife was complaining that some of the trees were dripping sap on her new lawn furniture, and so he and a neighbor were trying to cut the branches down. Now, this was the baseball season, and Jim was right-handed, and he wasn't going to use his arm for something like that. So he's swinging the scythe with his left arm and not doing very well. Anyway, they stop that. The friend leaves, and I start talking to Jim Palmer, and we're talking and talking and talking. And all of a sudden, he looks at his watch. He says, oh, it's 5:30. I should be at the ballpark by now. And he's running around the laundry room. Where are my socks? Where am I have to find my socks? Finally, he finds his socks, gets in his car, takes off for what was then called Memorial Stadium. I get in my car, follow. Turns out, this is September. He's pitching. And the Baltimore Orioles were in contention for first place, playing against the Boston Red Sox. This was maybe the most important game of Jim Palmer's season. He was pitching that night, and he'd spent all day with me. Now, imagine LeBron James or Tom Brady, any athlete, spending that amount of time with a reporter. So that's why I look back and think maybe I was able to work in a better time.
I love the book, by the way. Can I ask you about something that Sally Jenkins wrote about you that you quote in it? Diane would saunter through the locker room wearing Armani and a gold wristwatch, radiating, quote, I don't need this fucking job.
I love that quote.
Why'd you put it in the book?
You know, I put it because I liked it. I just thought it was funny. And I don't know if that's the way I looked. I mean, I didn't have a gold wristwatch. I had a nice one, but it wasn't gold. There was a Laker, and he once said to me, oh, you're so shy. You know, you never can tell what impression you make on people. So I don't know where why she wrote that, but I thought it was funny, and I liked it.
The other thing that really struck me about the book was, like, you encountered a lot of sexism and really kind of what I found quite horrifying run-ins with like Jim Rice at one point tries to kiss you, and then there's a very strange interview with Mickey Mantle. Would you mind telling us that story?
Growing up, I was a big Yankee fan. I was a Mickey Mantle fan. I grew up in Chicago, but my dad was from New York, so he loved the Yankees, and I picked it up from him. He loved Joe DiMaggio. I loved his successor, Mickey Mantle. And when I got this job at the National Observer and they let me do what I want, Mickey Mantle had retired, but he had just been brought back as the Yankees' first base coach. Ah, I said to my editor, this is an important story. You better send me. So off I go, and I'm really, really nervous. This was my childhood hero, and I was going to get to meet him. So the Yankees let me down on the field, and I'm standing by the dugout waiting for Mantle to come out. This was during batting practice. And one of the players said, you know, who are you waiting for? And I said, Mantle. And he goes, oh, okay. And he goes and he gets Mantle. He asked me to come into the dugout. And I don't know if you've been in one, but you walk through the, it gets kind of like this dark hallway that leads from the dugout to the locker room. And so Mantle was there, and he said, oh, I forgot you was waiting for me. And he agreed to let me interview him after the game. And he was staying in New York at the St. Moritz Hotel. He said to meet him there at 6 or 6:30, I don't remember which. And I said, okay. So I get to the hotel, and I call, and the operator said, he put me through to him. He was in the bar. He said, I'm in the bar. Meet me in the bar. I said, oh, okay. So I go into this. It's a big room, and he's sitting at a table, and he's got a drink in front of him, half a drink in front of him. I think he'd had several already, and I am so nervous. And I sit down, and back then, every interview I had ever heard someone do with Mantle, the first question was always the same, which was, hey, Mickey, how are your legs? Because he had bad legs. So that's what I said. Hi, Mickey, how are your legs? And he said, not so nice as yours. I thought, okay, bad question. So he's being very good at this interview, and he keeps calling for more drinks. And I don't know, hour and a half goes by, we're still talking. And I asked him, he had four sons, and I said, are they going to play baseball? And he said, well, maybe the oldest one. And I said, I don't know why. I said something about, well, how long have you been married? And he said, oh, too long. And he reaches into his inside jacket pocket and pulls out a greeting card, and he hands it to me. And I assumed, I don't know, it had flowers on the front. It looked like, I was thinking, maybe this is a card he's sending his wife. I open it up, and it said, let's have sex, but he used a different word. And I didn't know what to do. I just handed the card back. And right then, two friends came in. We ended up all going to dinner. Mantle kept drinking. And the final part of the story, we walked out of the restaurant. We were getting ready to cross a street, and he slipped on the curb and fell. And as I wrote, for one split second, my hero was lying in the gutter. And he jumped to his feet, and he said, new shoes. And that was my Mickey Mantle story. It taught me one important lesson: never interview or get to know your heroes.
Yeah, but when you were given that card, I'm kind of surprised you didn't walk out and leave. Did you feel you couldn't?
No, I think in many ways, I really always had blinders on, and I think it helped me with a lot of this stuff, especially some of the things being the first. I had two goals. One, let me in the locker room and answer my questions. I have a story to write. I'm on deadline. I thought it made Mantle look bad. I wasn't going to leave. I had a story to write. And I didn't feel threatened at that point. I let it go. I let a lot of things go. The only thing I cared about is just don't get in my way. If you get in my way or threaten me physically, that's a different story. Otherwise, I just tried to do the job.
Did you regret letting a lot of these things go? Because there are a ton of, now they're not quite as ostentatious as what Mickey Mantle did, but there are plenty of these stories that you reference in the book, and I'm wondering, is the regret on your part that you let them go, or was that just the jeopardy of doing business, I guess?
No, to the contrary. My attitude was this. Okay, I come to LA, I have this important job, and the Raiders, the Los Angeles Raiders football team, they won't let me in the locker room. I'm going to figure that out myself. I'm not going to go to my editor and dump a bunch of girl sports writer problems on his desk. I didn't believe in lawsuits. I got involved in one, but it was without my permission. I wanted to figure out how to solve the problem myself. And every time that I did, it was such a feeling of empowerment. And I think that's something that many people might think about today. If a guy looks at me funny or says something, so what? That doesn't threaten my job. You know, he's a jerk. Or, you know, there were some examples, a couple in the book, of me giving it back to them. It didn't, I have to say, it never really bothered me because it never threatened me physically or my job. So I felt good that I could solve my own problems. And I think it's something that maybe some people might try to do before running to HR or a lawyer.
Yeah, I'm caught between, when I was reading the book, I was caught between admiring your stoicism and in your resolve when you end up in these scenarios, and then kind of questioning a world which requires such stoicism, if you know what I mean. I think that that's something that I've learned, and especially with the Me Too movement of the last few years, that the fact that you perhaps couldn't feel like you could dump a load of, to use your phrase, girl problems on your editor's desk was probably a testament to the world you were living, or to the world you were working in. Is that fair?
Well, I don't know, because other women did go to their, you know, other women did more than, handled it differently than I did. I just thought, hey, this is my job. I got to figure out how to do it. I've got a deadline. I've got competitors. You know, I got to get this done. Today, I think, I don't know, I hear stories. I'm not involved in this world anymore. I hear stories not just from sports, but from other situations. And I'm just shocked at what comes out of some of the mouths of men. I don't know where these people come from. But I did feel good. Now, again, if I had felt threatened, you know, my job was threatened or my body was threatened, I would have gotten help. But in these situations, I sort of took it on as a challenge, and it made me feel good. You know, the times when I talked my way into the locker room, I really thought that was cool. So that it had to be like that, yeah. It's too bad it had to be like that. But it did. It was. And I suspect, I don't know, you're in a better position than me. This probably was true in other countries, right? When women tried to write sports.
Yeah, yeah. We had a previous guest of ours, Anna Kessel, worked in the UK and began writing in the last 10 years or so, and shared quite apparent stories.
And she's still having those problems, problems?
Well, she was up to a few years ago. Yeah, absolutely. So it's not. Yeah. And that was the stories she told were in the context of other male journalists rather than athlete journalist.
Yeah, I always felt, I believe that the athletes and even the sports writers, probably some of them talk behind my back. But I didn't care. I wasn't trying to be friends with the athletes. That's not what I set out to do. I didn't want to be their friend. And the sports writers, for the most part, were very helpful to me. I can't remember a single sports writer being unkind. Now, that didn't mean they didn't talk behind my back, but they didn't cause me any problems. I guess I just got lucky in some ways, or maybe it's how I presented myself. And again, I don't know how I presented myself. But people pretty much left me alone.
Well, you ask Sally Jenkins, you presented yourself by radiating that I don't need this fucking job.
Well, maybe she got it right.
Diane, you mentioned there that you weren't out there to make friends with the athlete. And I think that rings true for Larry Bird, who you wrote a profile on. And Larry Bird responded by saying, "If I see that girl again, I'll spit in her face." How in the name of God did you end up in this situation?
Okay, what happened was Larry Bird was a rookie. He was showing up for training camp in, I guess, August, September. And I was asked to write a cover story on him for Newsweek had just started a new monthly magazine called Inside Sports. And the new editor said, "Diane, we want you to do a cover story on Larry Bird." So I went up to Boston to training camp. I had to do a lot of homework because I hadn't paid that much attention at that time to college sports, college basketball. And, you know, obviously it took me about 3 minutes to realize this guy's already a hero before he's even played a game. So I did this story, and I worked with his, I guess his agent. His name was Bob Wolf. And Larry, well, he called himself a hick from French Lick, Indiana, and he was. He was, I don't know, 21 and 22, very unsophisticated. He'd grown up in a town of about 2,000 people, and he was totally out of his comfort zone coming to Boston and also dealing with the legions of reporters they have there. But anyway, I followed him around for a day or two, and he acted like a very young person. Just one example, and that I put in the book. I was invited to meet him over lunch. His agent, Bob Wolf, had arranged lunch in Boston at the Prudential Center. There was a fancy restaurant, and they were telling stories and laughing at the stupidest things. The agent, he was saying, you know, I was in my kitchen one night and the doorbell rang, and I opened the back door and there was no one there, and I closed the doorbell rang again, and I opened the door, I stepped outside, and Larry, you know, threw me to the ground, and they're laughing, you know. So there was that. Now we get to training camp, and I need to have a sit-down interview. And 2 days in a row, Larry didn't show up. So now it's a Friday. I have to get back to New York to write this story. I'm supposed to meet him at, I don't know, 8:30 in the morning. I'm there. He's not. I get on the phone, and I call my Newsweek colleague, Pete Axsom, and I'm saying, I don't know what to do. He's not here, blah, blah, blah. And, well, have you called Bob Wolf? Have you done this? I said, who the fuck does he think he is? And just then I looked in the doorway, and Bird was standing there looking at me. I hung up, sat down, interviewed him. He didn't speak in concise sentences. But, you know, we did talk. And then I had done a little homework on my own while I was waiting for him in the day or two before. I had called his brother in Indiana. I'd found out he had a wife, I think an ex-wife at that time, and a child, and he wasn't paying child support. His father, it turns out, had committed suicide. Anyway, I got all this information, and I put it in my story. And apparently the sports writers in Boston were aware of these things but had never been able to confirm them. Larry would never talk about these things. But when my story came out, the sports writers in Boston said, hey, Larry, look, it's out there, so can we just sit down and go through it with you, and that'll be the end of it. And one of the sports writers called me up and said, Larry said, if he ever sees you again, he'll spit in your face.
Jesus.
Well, I wasn't worried because I didn't think I'd see him again. But then, I don't know, a year later, there I am, a columnist in L.A., and the biggest rivalry in sports were the Lakers and the Celtics. So when I saw, and at the time, the sports writers sat at tables under the basket. So every time I saw Larry dribbling in my direction, I kind of sunk down in my chair a little bit. But he never did.
Did you ask him about those family issues that you reported on, or was it just a case of you putting them in the piece?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. I don't remember that. No, I probably didn't. But I got confirmations on those two. I felt sure that they were correct. And I can't remember that I asked him. That's a very good question, which, of course, I should have. Maybe, I can't remember if I did or not. I can't remember. It was bound to come out. But as I thought back about the piece, as I was working on my book and I wanted to write about this, I felt a little badly because I was kind of picking on a kid, and he'd had a pretty rough upbringing. And I thought, I don't know if I were writing this today, would I write it this way? Or I don't know, but I could see why he wasn't real happy with me.
Mm. Another big name, even bigger name than Larry Bird, who proved unhappy with details that you included in a profile of him, was Paul Newman. Can you explain what happened here?
Yes.
Because this is interesting, even from a journalistic point of view.
At the time, I was a writer at Newsweek, and I got a call from a publicist who said, listen, Paul Newman is going to be directing a play at his alma mater, and I'm trying to remember what it's called now. I can't remember the name. It's in Ohio. He's directing a student play, and he agreed to do two interviews. Would you like to do one of them? And I said, oh, yes. I'm sorry. It was Kenyon College in Ohio, small college, very good college. So the story was that this school had decided to build a new auditorium, and they had called Paul Newman in advance and asked for $2 million. And as he told me, I wasn't going to give them that, but I told them what I would do is I would come and direct the first student play in that auditorium. And this is what was happening now. So I get there, and it's just a crisp, fall crispy leaves, beautiful day. And he was renting or staying in the house of an older woman who had lent him the house. And he opened the door, and I was laughing because behind him were stacks of beer, cartons of beer, because he was a big beer drinker. And he said to me, it's such a beautiful day. How about if we go for a walk? Okay. So we start off, and I've got my tape recorder. And it's, you know, I'm walking. It's kind of swinging back and forth, holding him. And we walk for a while, and off to the left were these woods. And he said, oh, let's go into the woods. I said, okay. So we go into the woods, and I had these little heels on, and I was slipping and sliding on the slippery leaves. And he stopped, and he waited till I caught up with him, and then he looped his arm through mine, and he said, okay, and just kept walking. I thought, oh, my God.
Life has worked out pretty well to this point.
I'm supposed to think of a question to ask this guy. Is Robert Redford going to be riding up any minute? So anyway, we walked for quite a while, and he told me that that night he was cooking hamburgers for the students in this play, which he often did. And he said, come buy it. And I said, okay. So I raced back to my hotel room, and I wanted to play back the tape. And to my horror, all I got was the crunching of the leaves as I walked. No words.
Oh, God.
Oh my God. So it's a reporter's worst nightmare. So I start scribbling as fast as I can, everything I recall I'm saying. And then I go off to this barbecue. What I hadn't mentioned so far is that 3 weeks earlier, his son had OD'd and died. And Paul had not left. He had stayed there to direct these students. But before I went, I was told by the publicist, don't ask him about this. Okay. But once I was with the students, I asked them, you know, how did he handle it? What happened that day? And they said, well, that night we all put on funny costumes, and we went to his house, and we rang the bell, and he came out in this nightshirt, and we gave him a bottle of liquor and some beer, and he thanked us, and all he ever said after that was, be as noisy as you can. So I finished with Paul Newman, who couldn't have been nicer. In fact, as I was getting ready to leave the next day, he gave me his phone number. Can you believe that? Mm-hmm. He gave me his phone number. He said, if you have any questions, feel free to call. I said, okay. So on that few days later, it was a Monday, I'm working on the story at Newsweek, and I thought, you know, I have to use this thing about the students, but I need to run this by him. I don't think it's fair to put this in without talking to him about it. So I called the number he gave me. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and he answered the phone. He sounded sleepy, and I said, oh, did I wake you up? And he said, oh, don't worry, it's okay, but what do you need? So I asked him some basic questions just, you know, to confirm them. And then I said, I just wanted to ask you about the night Scott died and the students coming to your house. And he said, God damn it to hell, the kid is dead. Why don't people stop asking me or leave me alone? And he slammed the phone down. I can't tell you what it feels like to have Paul Newman hang up on you. I still get chills thinking about it. So I called back, he didn't answer, and I ended up writing it. And I think it was the nicest story I ever wrote about anybody. But a few days after the story appeared, he had sent a telegram. We had something called telegrams back then. And it said, I'm canceling my subscription to Newsweek. I'm going to get Screw magazine, Paul Newman. And the editor said, oh, my God, what should I do with this? I said, run it. Put it in letters to the editor. He's very angry, and he has a right to express it. So he was so angry that maybe 4 or 5 years later, he had a big movie coming out called The Verdict. And Time, our competitor, Newsweek, wanted to put him on the cover. Newsweek wanted to put him on the cover. He wouldn't deal with Newsweek. Time magazine got the cover. So now shall I jump ahead to the second Paul Newman?
Yeah, yes, please. The more Paul Newman content we can get here, Diane, the happier everyone will be.
Many years passed, I don't know, maybe 20, I can't remember exactly. I get a call from an editor I'd never heard of for a magazine, Modern Maturity, which I'd never heard of. It became the ARP, AARP magazine, but at the time it was called Modern Maturity. And this editor said he liked my work and they wanted to put Paul Newman on the cover because he was about to turn 75, I think it was. And I said, well, I'd love to do it, but I don't think he'll cooperate with me. And I told him the story. And he said, well, why don't you call Paul's publicist? I said, all right. So I called the publicist, who I knew, and I told him the story. And he said, all right, let me talk to Paul, get back to you. I said, okay. To my surprise, he called back and said, yeah, Paul said if you don't bring it up, he won't bring it up. Oh, okay. So now I'm seeing Paul, he's 75, and he's still really handsome, but he is 75. And he had just made a movie, and I think that's why he was willing to do publicity for it. I went to his home I went to two homes. One, he had an apartment in New York overlooking Central Park, and then he had a home in Connecticut. And I did two interviews, one in each place. Very nice, really nice guy. The sad part of it was, after I finished the interviews, the movie company screened the movie for me. And it was horrible. It was a really, really bad movie. And I got home from the screening. I had an apartment. I still had an apartment in New York. I got back, and there was a phone message from Paul Newman. And it said, Diane, would you give me a call? Okay, sure. I called him, and he said, you saw the movie? I said, yes. He said, well, what'd you think? And I just had to lie, and I said, oh, what a wonderful movie. You were terrific. And he said, thank you. He said, do you think a lot of people will go see it? I said, gee, who knows? You know, not even the producers know these things. He said, but you think it's good, right? And I said, oh, absolutely. The movie opened, and it closed very quickly. It did not do well. Mm. But so that was my Paul Newman episode.
To go back to the initial profile, is it a difficult decision to include that story about his son? Because at this point, you've struck up a really good relationship with Paul Newman. You know he's going to read it. You know he's not going to like it. You know, readers wouldn't realize if it was left out. Is it difficult? Is it a difficult decision to include it?
No, because I, as a journalist, I'm always looking for something interesting or colorful. And I thought it said something about him. You know, he was very, you know, he was very nice to his students. I think before they came to his house that day when they'd had some kind of rehearsal, and he'd said, please just be as noisy as you want. That'll help me. And then this, when they went to his house, I thought that was a more interesting thing to put in the story than stuff about the play. That nobody was, it was a Ford Foundation grant of some kind, stuff like that. I thought this would make people interested, or it was interesting. Did I know he wouldn't like it? I didn't.
Okay.
Because I think it didn't present him in a bad light.
We have two final questions, Diane, that we ask everyone. I'm sorry. You may have already covered them already, but the first one is, who is the most interesting person you've met through work?
The most interesting person I met, well, the one I'll remember the most will be Cary Grant.
Yeah.
Yes, he was interesting, yes. I would have to put him up there. Yes.
And Cary Grant tells you, like, you've a great line in the book that the difference between a columnist, being a columnist and being a reporter, is you're a name versus a byline. And it does seem to me like an ancient age where a sports columnist can be so well thought of in Hollywood that Cary Grant would ring them up to say, I like your work.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, like I said, and I think it's maybe still that way, but, I would. If you live in L.A., you drive. And if you drive, you're going to have interactions with the cops. You're going to get stopped for something at some point, or many times. Every time I get stopped, they look at my light. Oh, you're that sports columnist. Hey, what do you think the Raiders are going to do on Sunday? Or, you know, tell me about the Dodgers. So, yes, a lot of people knew who I was. And it was uncomfortable sometimes, too.
Was it? How did that manifest itself?
Well, just sometimes I would see people staring at me. That made me uncomfortable.
Because obviously they recognize your picture in the paper.
Yeah.
The most interesting place you've been with work, Diane?
The most interesting place? On two occasions, I did assignments in Moscow, in Russia. And one was for the Olympics, the Moscow Olympics in 1980. And the second time I went in, I think it was 94 after Perestroika. So supposedly the KGB were gone. The police now were your friends, and they had the mafia who were the bad guys. But it was just fascinating for me to see what it was like in Russia on both of those occasions.
Mm. I've got this great image of my head of the Russian police pulling you over to the side of the road and saying, oh, you're that sports columnist in Los Angeles.
That would have been too much, yes.
Diane, the book is called A Farewell to Arms, Legs and Jockstraps, a sports writer's memoir. What a title, by the way. And it's published by Red Lightning Books. We're very grateful to you for joining us on the show today. So thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was fun. Thank you again.
Yeah, huge thanks to Diane for her time. That book is available now if you want to go and get it. A quick reminder to get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie or tweet me, I'm @gcooney93. You can also get involved in the members' WhatsApp group. Details of how to do that are in the episode description of the podcast, but you know all about that already. Thanks, as always, for your support of the podcast and the 42 as a whole. We really do greatly appreciate it. We hope you are all keeping very well. And we're going to be back next week with another great guest here on Behind the Lines. But until then, take it easy.